Sunday night, and you are listening to The Ooze with your hosts T.C. Downey and Jason Sorrell. And damn, for a second there, it didn't seem like I was actually going to get on the air, man. What's going on with you tonight?
I'm trying to figure out what the hell this clown car we're driving called BTR is, man, because, I mean, it's been ridiculous. Yesterday, it was like Echo City. I thought it was my headset was all fucked up. Nobody could hear me. They were saying it was all choppy and shit. Now, you're told that it broke like, I don't know, probably 3 or 4 so far this year. And this one here, it's been the actual plastic of it got broken, but the wire and everything's still intact. So it's working, but I mean, it doesn't help that this Mickey Mouse engine is costing us $30 a month and it never fucking works right. I think I'm going to have to send off a letter of complaint to our hosts and tell them this shit just sucks.
Well, I know there are other services for this, so we can't get it resolved. And here's my thinking, though. There's no guarantee moving to someplace else that's going to be any better. I mean, if we can find someplace that's just better, then super. As they're saying now in the chat right now, you're having the same issues you're having the night before with the cutting in and out, man. But we'll figure this shit out, and we're going to make it a good show tonight. So what's been going on with you, man? What else has been – what have you been up to?
Fuck shit, man, really. I mean, all kinds of things. I've been on dad duty the past, 3 days. I got him early. I got him Thursday night, and his mom needed me to keep him late. He just picked him up literally like an hour ago. So that's one of the things that I've had going on. And another thing, I'm trying to think. There's all kinds of shit. I mean, yesterday we had a really good show, I think. Lehigh really was pulling its weight, and with Earl calling in, we seem to be knocking the ball out of the park in terms of fruitful discussions. So that's at least one positive side to it.
Right on. Right on.
So
cool.
I'm trying to get my phone going here.
And looks like we you're trying to call in with your phone. Okay.
Yeah, that's me. I got it. You should be hearing me better now.
Yeah, it's a lot better. So awesome. I was a little busy yesterday doing a tattoo. Nothing really has been going on. I've kind of been tracking this whole fallout or mass defection from the Brotherhood of Satan, and the video that I did on YouTube, the Fraternal Order of Satanic Rednecks, is causing these people to kind of, you know, get in touch with me for some reason, just to let me know that, hey, they left the Brotherhood of Satan, and they, you know, I mean, I was probably participating in this thing for like a whole 2 weeks before deciding, yep, I wasn't, you know, this was bullshit, just like I thought it was going to be bullshit, and said, you know, fuck it. And there are people I'm talking to who have been in for 5-6 years and just have come to the same conclusions that they're not getting anywhere, they're not seeing anything, nothing's being, none of the promises are being met or being kept, which is typical of these kinds of organizations. But what I find, you know, odd is that, you know, why are they flocking to me? Because, I mean, I understand I put a video out there and everything, but, you know, what is it they're hoping to get other than, you know, somebody going, yeah, right on, those guys suck. And I pointed out to one of these people recently, I was like, you know, it's kind of interesting that you've got these people who are invested in this organization who their whole identity was this organization. And now that this organization has failed them, now that they've turned their backs on this organization, their whole identity has become wrapped up in tearing this organization down. So it's kind of crazy. It's been a weird week with all that.
Right on. I guess other interesting news. I've kind of expanded my own personal clan a bit. I've aligned myself with Dan Dredd, Mindflux, Topic Momentum, Lickety Pup,
Daryl, and a couple other dudes, Diavolo. We've all kind of pulled together with this 3.0 idea. Pretty cool stuff, you know. It was right up my alley. I mean, the whole idea of transgression and, you know, amorality and, you know, that the political resistance, so to speak. So, you know, they waved that flag in my face, and I just couldn't turn my eyes away from that pretty little shiny thing. So, I'm interested to see how that works out.
Now, this is the L316 Nexian or whatever they call it, right?
Well, L316 is actually, it's its own separate deal. That's a group of guys that have known each other for a very, very long time, and they have their own little collective. 3.0 is something that L316 is in line with,
right?
But it's not necessarily the same thing.
Well, I've been reading through the different articles, checking it out and everything else, and it looks top-notch. Everything I've been reading about and everything else, it sounds, I mean, the same things we've been talking about, a little bit more aggressive, but it still seems like also it's talking about the ideology still. It's not necessarily telling anybody, you know, what to do, how to do it, or how to go about it, which, you know, can be good and can be bad. And the people you just named, you know, Dan Dredd, Entropic Momentum, Daryl, you know, the Interrogist, those guys are all, you know, really sharp. So, you know, and definitely now bringing you on board, I'm waiting to see, you know, what goes down with all that, because it just should be interesting. And I guess it's kind of in line with some of the stuff I wanted to talk about tonight, about how something like 3.0 is going to be necessary, I think, especially with what we see going on with the Occupy movement.
What, you mean the not really so much stuff going on with the Occupy movement?
Well, it seems like it's starting to implode, and I kind of wanted to get, you know, our listeners, as people come into the chat room and everything else, their thoughts on what they're hearing about the Occupy movement. There's a bunch of different things going on where, you know, you talk about this movement being kind of a grassroots movement of the people, but there's always been this rumor that's been organized by a political group, that they pose the idea of, you know, corporate money being injected into the political system. They pose the idea of banks' money being injected into the political system, but they're backed by a fundraising organization, and they've denied that, and, you know, a lot of the people who are participating in it are very much, you know, opposed to that kind of thing, and very much thought it was just this a movement, much like the Tea Party, although the Tea Party, you know, freely admits that they are definitely organized by, you know, right-leaning conservative groups. Well, like, just some of the things off the top of my head recently that have happened, and I actually put this on the Ooze WordPress page. So there's a short description here. Occupy Portland recently was given $20,000, a donation. It's the biggest donation they've received to date. A few days ago, they actually marched on a Wells Fargo, and marching on this Wells Fargo in protest. And here in Austin, they marched on Bank of America and stuff like that. But when they marched on Wells Fargo, they actually did some damage to the building. There was some vandalism. There was some, you know, graffiti spray painted and everything else. So they go and they raise hell at this Wells Fargo. On November 5th, of course, the Occupy movement as a whole told people that, hey, we want you to take your money out of these big banks. We want you to move them to a credit union. We want to show the banks that, you know, we can use our money in our own way rather than turning it over to you folks to use in whatever way you use for your own political ends. So the Occupy movement is very much against big banks. But when they get handed this $20,000 donation, they, instead of taking it to a credit union, instead of following their own advice and going that way, they deposited it to Wells Fargo, you know, the bank that they had just protested 3 or 4 days ago. You know, they come to this conclusion via General Assembly. They every day they have a vote. You know, they have these different issues they're going to discuss. They have everybody who's participating, they vote. But then, of course, you've got a number of people who are making their arguments one way or another. So I'm sure the arguments were probably that, the Wells Fargo is right down the street, so the money will be accessible, that at $20,000, your best, payout on interest is going to be this or that or what have you. So I'm sure there was a winning argument, but it kind of opposes their ideals to, invest in a bank. It's that kind of hypocrisy that's just becoming more and more apparent in the Occupy movement that I think is going to be its undoing.
Right. Well, it really kind of, in my opinion, points directly to the fact that the Occupy movement itself has become somewhat of a fad. I don't think that as many people that are attending these things are as many that are pissed off about everything that's going on as they are just, wanting to say, yeah, I was there at that movement. I mean, hell, I've known some guys who were at the Kent State protest who went there just simply because all their hippie buddies were doing it. They didn't have anything invested in it.
Right. I agree with that. It's just something to do for a lot of these people. It's just something to, something to be at, something that's something other than, watching TV or playing video games, smoking pot in your mom's basement or whatever. And that's one of the problems these people are running into is that the people that are invested in it are kind of just invested in half-assed. If it means doing anything hard or doing anything difficult, taking out of the equation the protesters in Oakland, a lot of these people don't seem to be willing to do it. And it seems it's just half-assed. I mean, like the situation we're describing. You oppose the banks, yet when it comes time for you to make a decision about how you're going to deal with your money, you go ahead and invest or deposit, your money into this bank. And it's something that we've talked about here on the show as well, is that they don't seem to go far enough. They sit there and say that the system is flawed, that they have issues with the way things are being ran. But instead of really opposing those people who are running the system, those different processes that they oppose, instead of really standing up to it and really trying to tear it down or turning their backs on it, they just ask the people that, they oppose to change it for them. It's like you've got somebody that's beating the shit out of you every day, okay, and they do it, they're good at it. They're good at pounding the shit out of you. And you decide one day that you're going to stand up, you're not going to throw blows, you're not going to defend yourself, but you're just going to, rally together with your friends, and you're all going to stand there and please stop beating the shit out of me. And it's just, why? Why would anybody stop? Why would they bother with that? So, yeah, it's just kind of, it's just not making a lot of sense in my mind. And I mean, there's just a number of things going on that I take issue with, which is why, when we're talking about 3.0, you're talking about a core group of people and a potential ideology being developed that might actually mean something. It might actually have some momentum or gain some traction.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the whole point of the whole thing is actually doing something. I mean, let's, scratch our fucking head for a minute and look at what you just described. What you described was a dog asking its master to loosen its collar up a little bit. Not take the collar off, loosen it up a little bit. Hey, I'm kind of getting this rash right here. You mind loosening this up a little bit so I can get a rash somewhere else?
Right. Yeah. Or I'm still under control. I'm still, yours to do with what as you see fit. And all I want is a little bit more breathing room. Yeah. Yeah. And it's instead of going, I don't need the collar. I don't need the leash. Don't need the master. Time to turn around and bite somebody.
And that's exactly the idea being pushed forward by 3.0 is not needing that master. I mean. The ultimate idea here, the only system that I see viable personally, is one of small organized groups and not this mega society that we've developed. So for better or worse, I would say that a state of anarchy would be ideal over anything that's been put forward in the past, 300 or 400 years.
And whenever you talk about anarchy, whenever anybody mentions anarchy, both sides of the political spectrum, they get all weirded out by that. And it's because they take, when you say anarchy, they assume it's going to be chaos. That anarchy is going to mean true and pure lawlessness. And in fact, anarchy just means that there's no centralized government. There's no centralized authority. It's just a matter, you know, the people come together and they make decisions for the benefit of their group. And that's only effective when you're dealing with small groups, which, frankly, you know, again, as you and I have discussed on previous shows, that seems to be the ideal way that human beings interact with one another. When we get to this point where, you know, you've got, you know, a million people living in the same city, well, then you're going to have stratification that puts most people so far away from the people who are making the decisions about for their lives that nobody's going to feel like they're getting an equitable break. Nobody's going to feel like they have any power, any leverage in what's going on. So then you take it where you can get it.
Right, right. And in essence, that means, you know, asking for your collar to be loosened up so you can walk around and piss on the next dog's bowl of food. You know, I mean, you see it all day long. These people who, you know, they want something different. They want something better, but they do the same shit to each other that they're complaining about being done to themselves. It's the most asinine mentality I've ever witnessed, and it's something that seems to be predominant in the human race at this point.
All right, right, right. And precise example, turning our attention back to this Occupy movement thing, they are all for, well, they want resources to be evenly distributed. They want a fair shot, in their opinion, at the same resources, the same wealth as these other people are displaying. You know, maybe not, they want it equally distributed. They think there should be an upper, you know, amount that any one person will need or ever want, which is all fine and good. That's fair. In my opinion, I kind of agree with that idea. Especially if, let's say you're talking about a small group, how much wealth would you need to have status within that group? You know, this is, I mean, it's just part of the symptom of this mass society we have, where if you're going to be wealthy, well, to be wealthy, you know, to really stand out, you have to go above and beyond. Well, while these people are sitting there talking about how they want a fair and equitable redistribution of the wealth, when they started gathering materials and resources for their own needs, you know, food, water, things like that, and other people came along, you know, in this case the homeless and transients came along and started consuming these resources, well, these people cried foul. They also, they didn't want a fair and equitable redistribution of the wealth. It meant that their wealth, what little they have, was being redistributed to people that they didn't feel earned it, which is the same argument that they call cruel and heartless when these millionaires and billionaires say, why should I share with you what I have when you didn't earn it? So it's just, it's hypocrisy. And it really comes down to a point of, you know, if the only way this is, you're going to achieve what you're trying to achieve through these movements is if you're willing to turn your back on that system, if you're willing to make sure that that system no longer has any control of you.
Yeah, I would agree with that, man. I mean, you know, I guess the question at hand really for everybody listening is who is John Galt? You know, that's the question.
Right, right. And it's, you know, making sense of the idea that you need to be your own master. And it starts with, you know, you as the individual. You have to make that decision that you're no longer going to just without any thought, follow the laws, follow the rules, follow the normal way of doing things, that you really need to investigate what it is that you need to do, what it is you want to accomplish, why you do things, turning back to that same Gurdjieff philosophy, but not just in your thinking and psychology, but literally, you know, your modes of behavior, the reasons you go to work, the reasons you pay certain bills, things like that. And deciding for yourself what it is you're going to do and not do, and recognizing how your participation in something is kind of limiting or beginning to limit the parameters you have, the options you have in your life.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because this in some ways sort of parallels what I was thinking about talking tonight if we ran out of things to discuss. And one of the things that I thought we might talk about is why. Why act? Why, you know, why do things? Why transgress? You know, Is it fruitless? Most people, I think, believe so.
Now, see, I couldn't understand having that mentality, where people think it's not worth the effort. I mean, the only people who think if you've given up, you know, you've totally accepted the rule of somebody else, then I could see you saying there's no point. There's no point in making that effort. But for me, you know, as long as there's breath in my body, I'm going to resist control from someone else. I'm always going to be searching for that way of, you know, really breaking free, of really, you know, achieving these ideals that have been drummed into me, that I've embraced, that, you know, hey, we are free to do what we want to do. You're free to live your life as you choose to live it. That seems to be, you know, it's those things are already eroding before our eyes. It's becoming platitudes we tell our children just to keep them, you know, in line and keep them, you know, working in the direction we want them to work in.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, I've been sitting here thinking about it. When I was a teenager, I was a pretty mischievous kid. When I was a young adult, I was a pretty mischievous young adult. The same kind of thing can be said about me now. I'm pretty mischievous. But my motivations have changed. When I was younger, I was angry and I didn't know why. You know, it pissed me off that other people thought that they had the right to fucking tell me, you know, to tell me whatever I could do or couldn't do, what I was capable of or what I wasn't capable of. You know, pissed me off to think that other people thought they were better than me, just based on whatever, you know, remedial assessments they'd made in their own mind to justify their fucking pretension. In my 20s, it got to be more about the challenge. You know, just being able to say, hey, I pulled all this shit off and nobody will ever know it, not even the authorities.
Mm.
And, you know, that part was pretty cool. Well, now, you know, my motivation is different. I don't want my own kid. I don't want to have to look at him in 10 years and say, dude, you know, I know it sucks that you got to do what the man tells you to do. And I'm sorry, but I didn't do anything about it. You know, and I just can't do that, man.
Right. So it's become a matter of guided effort where, you know, transgression, I think, comes naturally to people like you and I. That, you know, we look for, as soon as somebody says, here's the way the game is played, we start looking for alternatives. We start looking for advantages. We start looking for ways to get around shit. I mean, it just comes naturally. And I have dealt with people actually who consider that a negative character trait. To be opportunistic, to seek advantages. And, well, you know, what's funny, though, is that when we talk about, you know, historical figures, we talk about success in business or anything else, it always comes down to the guy that looked for advantages, the guy that was willing to break the rules, to take the risks, to do that kind of thing. Those are the people that more often than not were successful. The people that absolutely followed the rules, that did what they were told, that kept their head, you know, their head down, their nose to the grindstone, they tended not to have the same level of success. We're talking about transgression. Now it's not just a matter, and this is something I think we've, you know, also pointed out, it's not just a matter of breaking rules. It's not just a matter of, you know, going out there and just doing shit to do it, but it's actually a directed effort. Now, you know, when you do something, you do it for a reason, and it's, you know, seeking ways to live. I mean, because if you live by a process where what you do is you're given a law and you do the opposite. The system, in my opinion, is prepared for that situation where that's one of the things they would expect you to do is that you're given a rule and you choose to break it. You do the direct opposite, just out of habit. You're still being governed, still being guided by that system, even though everything you do is, you know, is a effort to oppose it. Instead of finding your own way, instead of finding your own things, ignoring their expectations. That's something that people, I think, are surprised about Satanism. With Satanism, they assume that it's just immediately anti-Christianity. And that's not, at least in my experience, has been that's not the case at all. That it's a matter of, you know, defining things for yourself, which means sometimes you're going to be right in alignment with Christianity as far as your ideas and the morals you have or morals you lack or what have you. But there are going to be things, though, that you differ wildly from, you know, whatever it is you oppose.
Right on, man. Right on. comes to my mind, I've had this thing kind of batting around in my head. I learned this past weekend that 2013, Tampa, the city of Tampa, will be housing the Republican National Convention.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting to me because this is a predominantly Democratic area. So I've been trying to, like, think about ways to actually, to start some shit, for lack of a more sophisticated sounding terminology. So that's something I've been batting around a lot in my head lately. Here is an opportunity to really get people in an uproar. But the question becomes how to do that, because the only way anything's ever going to change is if you get enough people to kick sledgehammers to the proverbial concrete walls. You and I, we're both about the same age, so we both watched on MTV and other television channels as the Berlin Wall came down.
Right.
And for a while, that meant something to us. You know, that was a big thing. That was tyranny, or at least what we had been convinced was, you know, the archetype of tyranny being torn down.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is people just stop there. And, you know, I've been reading a lot of Thomas Paine again lately and kind of going through some of the ideas that he put out in his time, because in my opinion, he was a very motivational writer during his period in time. He was not only a motivational writer, but he was prepared to actually take action himself. I mean, the man spent the last 20 years of his life in and out of prison, in England particularly, because he decided to take the revolution further, which I think kind of adds exactly to what I'm pointing to, is that it wasn't enough just to get one spot free for him. You know, he wanted to continue to keep pushing against. It's interesting because one of the things that Thomas Paine said was something along the lines of virtues are acquired through endeavors. Endeavors, they rest wholly upon yourself. So to praise other people for their virtues, it can only encourage your own effort. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. When you look to somebody and you say, hey, I really dig that you're doing this, keep going, it kind of gives you that drive. You look over to the person over there and you go, well, he's actually doing something. Why don't I put my best foot forward? And then you have no choice but to own it. You have to own up to either, you know, you're a pussy and you're whipped and you don't mind being a cog in the wheel. Complacency is your bag of chips. Or you wake up to the fact that you've got a voice. And that voice should be used. You should, this gripped tight, raised up in the air, screaming at the top of your lungs, using that voice. It's not enough to be heard by just a few around you. It's not enough to be heard by your entire community even. If you feel strongly enough about something, you should want to fire the shot that's heard around the world. And I think until people get that mentality into their head, we're going to continue to see stuff like this Occupy movement that just fizzles out rather than becoming what it really needs to be and owning the situation that it's really in.
Right. If these people were serious about what it is they're trying to accomplish, it wouldn't be a matter of just going someplace and making demands and insisting the system, cater to these demands. It would be, them just saying, we're out, we're done. We're going to go over here now, and this is where we're going to be, and we're gonna you know, do our own thing, raise our own food, make our own lives happen. Fuck you and fuck you guys. You know, if you want to come here and take this away from us, we're going to have to, you're going to have to do it so in a violent and very public manner, take us out. And what you're talking about with, you know, people being unwilling to do something until they see the example set by somebody else, I think that's one of the most powerful tools that this system has to oppress us. The idea that, you know, it's put in our heads that if we obey, if we follow, well, then we have the strength of our friends and neighbors and everybody else who's obedient behind us. But if we disobey, if we transgress, well, then we are alone. We are by ourselves. And the fact of the matter is, there is more of us willing to transgress than there are people who are willing to obey. It's not human nature to just be obedient. It's not human nature to just toe the line. We all have a streak within us to be individual, to, you know, to really find out what it is we, you know, the thing that makes us human is the urge to discover who we are and to, you know, have that voice and to speak out and to, you know, to make our mark, to live the matter we see fit. You know, so the idea that you're alone when you try to do something like that is just pure bullshit. Do you remember the, there's this guy here in Texas, Joe Sack. Have you heard that name in the news out in Florida?
Yes.
Okay. This is a guy who a couple years ago flew an airplane into the IRS building. He made some lousy business deals. He had, you know, been in and out of some bad situations as far as a divorce and all kinds of shit going on. The guy wasn't doing too bad. He could afford to have an airplane. He had his own home. He had, you know, he wasn't doing too bad. But what his deal was is he played by the rules. He played by the, you know, he went with what the system told him was the way for him to live his life. And he jumped through all these different hoops only to be burned at the end, okay? And I'll freely say that the guy was fully responsible for his own downfall, fully responsible for his own demise. But he recognized that complicit in that demise, complicit in that downfall, was this system, and in particular his target was the IRS. So the IRS is going to take back everything he had. They're going to wipe him out. They're basically going to make him homeless. You know, his home was going to be gone, his boats, his planes, everything was going to be gone. His businesses had already been failed, they're already dried up and everything. So he, you know, he destroyed his home. He's like, you know, to hell with that. He burns the place down. He gets in his airplane, and he flies this plane into the IRS building. Now, this is an extreme act of a man who was just he was desperate. He had reached his limit. The way the story is spun, of course, by the news media and the people that deal with it now, is the man was just crazy. Okay, I think only one person actually died in this strike on the IRS building. He wanted to destroy the structure. It was supposed to be a symbolic blow. I don't think he was actually out to kill anybody. You know, somebody happened to be in the building. He hit it early in the morning, and somebody happened to be in the building when it went down. And while I don't, and I, we could not on the air condone this type of behavior, I thought when I heard this story that there were going to be people who were going to see Joseph Sack as a hero. And you know, we look at, you know, all the instances in our own history as a country of people who are willing to sacrifice, who are willing to, you know, give up their lives and go against the powers that be to and have died. Going against those powers to, you know, for their ideals. And here's a man doing the exact same thing, and I'm hoping that one day I'm in a world where Joe Sack is considered a hero rather than a kook.
Right on. Well, if I remember this dude correctly, the thing that actually ended up discrediting him was the weakness shown in, because it was a suicide crash, right? If I remember right.
Yeah, right. He did not plan to survive.
He left like a fucking 9-page suicide letter. And that weakness, that weakness was spun to make it look like he was a pathetic human being rather than actually embracing the nobility, if I can loosely use that word, of his action.
Right. 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 I mean, he was pointing out that he could not win against these people, that there was no, you know, he was dealing with the IRS, and that, you know, there was no there was no wiggle room, basically. He was trying to follow the rules and do what he was trying to, you know, he wanted to make, you know, to achieve some success for himself and his family and what have you. And he made bad choices. You know, it's a risk. When you go into business, it's a risk. And that's kind of what you got going on. But he found himself, and he tried to follow the rules as far as the IRS is concerned, and he got caught in some weird little loophole or weird little tax quagmire, and, like I said, got burned for it. This nine-page suicide letter, this nine-page manifesto, he goes through and point by point, you know, establishes, here's where I was burned on this, here's where I was burned on that. And it's hard to, when you read through that documentation and everything, it's hard to sit there and say, well, you know what, I could see, you know, where that would be a problem, where that wasn't fair, where that wasn't correct. Yet it could be done to any of us. You could argue that our government, you know, does it to people on a regular basis. They want you out of, you own a home, your family owns a home, and they've passed that home on to you for generations. Generation to generation has gotten this home. You've maintained the land. You've kept the home upkeep of the home taken care of. You've paid the balloon payments. You paid the taxes. And the day that your local government decides, hey, you know what? We want to turn that strip of land that you're on into a fucking mall, they find a reason to take it to pull it out from under you. If you don't take what they offer you, less than the value of the land, they put you in jail.
Right on. I mean, and it's worse than that because they will literally strong arm you into taking whatever they feel it's worth. It doesn't matter that it has, you know, that sentimental value or that lineage of heritage on that particular plot of land. As far as they're concerned, they own it. And, well, you're just pretending like you are.
Right. And if you play by their rules, if you go by the way they do things, that's exactly what's going on. When you own a piece of property, it should be yours. If that's the concept that you can actually wrap your head around, you own this land. Okay, the Native Americans didn't agree with that concept, but we did. Mark Twain agreed with it, and everything else that you could own land. So you own this property. So this property is your domain. Well, then within your domain, within your property, you should be able to establish the law. You are, in fact, the law. You own this land. That's the way it should be. If you own this land, right. So if you own this land, it's up to you to do what you will with this land to support yourself, if that's what you want to do. Or if you're affluent enough in whatever it is you do to own this land without having to actually work it, to get anything to produce it, well, then it's still yours. That's the way it should be. The way it is now, though, the county, the state, the city, they assess the value of your land, and, of course, it's always on the increase, and they tell you, because you own X, amount of land and this value, well, you owe taxes on that value. So you don't just buy it and pay for it once and own it, like any fucking thing else in your house. You end up paying for it over and over and over again because of the way that the state's set up. In feudal systems, you know, if you were a noble lord, if you were a baron, and you were given a certain amount of property, title to a certain property or whatever, well, then you had a responsibility to pay taxes from your property. And again, it's the same thing. That's what we're doing here. If you own land, you're engaged in, you don't have serfs to turn to. You're not working the land or anything. So it's either you pay the taxes out of your own toil and labor or they take it away. Well, if you own it, if it's yours, how can they take it away? So
that's precisely the problem we keep running into, man, is that nothing is truly yours and you are not really free. And for anybody to try to fucking say otherwise, I'll just tell them straight up, they're full of shit.
Well, I think that's probably one of the first places we need to start when we're talking about transgression, is recognizing that our values, the things we are told that we should try to strive for, the things that we should achieve, are not decided by us, but are rather instilled in us by this system. And if we're going to truly transgress, the first place we have to transgress is in our values. So, you know, recognizing that there's no point in owning something if it can just be taken away from you, then ownership, the value of ownership, should go away. Now, if you're going to transgress, one of the things you should do is go, you know, I shouldn't necessarily have to own anything. Or if I do own something, it's stuff that I can protect with my own two hands. That, you know, if somebody's going to take this away from me, they're going to earn it because they're going to have to kick my ass to get it. Versus striving for property, versus striving for material goods and everything. I'm a materialistic motherfucker. I like having nice shit. But, you know, it's what I have better have some sort of utility for me as well. What I have better have a reason for having this beyond a symbol of my own affluence. So transgressing on those values. If you're never going to be able to own the land anyways, why purchase the property? Unless there's a larger cause for that property, unless you could actually work that land and protect it and declare it is truly yours, then there's no point in going after that value and going after that goal.
Right on. I mean, you know, now that I'm sitting here thinking about it, maybe one of the better ways for that Occupy movement to have taken its manifestation would have been if everybody just occupied, you know, 1/4 acre.
Right.
You know, you just pick a 1/4 acre and start building. And they come try to knock it down and, you know, you fucking resist.
Right. Go out into, it would have made more sense. I understand that this, because they have a different political agenda. They're still playing within the system. But in my mind, instead of going out and occupying this park or whatever, occupying the city hall here in Austin, Texas, if they had gone out in the woods and occupied a piece of land that the city and state had set aside as not being developed because, you know, for whatever reason, it's along a waterway or whatever the situation was, and chose to live there. You know, they fish the local stream, they hunt the local forest or whatever, and they're just going to live this way in these encampments, that would have made more sense to me. We're truly tired of the system. We're truly turning our backs on things, and this is what we're going to do. And it's something I think that, you know, we're building towards as idealists, as philosophers. We're moving towards this idea that at some point, and for me, I think it's probably the same for you, we're moving to that point when we're able to say that it's not of consequence to someone who didn't have the same choices we have. That if I choose to pack up all my shit and go to Florida or whatever, you know, to do whatever it is I'm going to do, well, that choice does not impact my children. That my children have, you know, the same opportunities I have, the same options I have. I want to instill in them my values. I want to instill in them, you know, these ideas. But I want to make sure that they come to these conclusions on their own. But there's other people who they don't have those same obligations. Who I just wonder, you know, you know, you say fight the man, you say, you know, you're going to do this, that, or the other, and you still have a regular job, you still work at a 9-to-5, you know, you're still, you know, doing whatever it is you do, and it might be for them a process as well. It might be for them that, you know, I'm working this 9-to-5 until I, you know, there are certain goals I have to accomplish first before I'm able to say fuck it and walk away. But I think we need to make that commitment eventually, that we're going to eventually say, fuck it, and walk away.
Yeah, I think the old axiom, put up or shut up, is perfectly valid here. You know, it's time for people to either say, you know what, I'm a fucking machine, I'm a cog in the wheel, I like being told what to do, yes sir, may I have another, or fuck you. And if that's fuck you to everybody.
Right.
You know, and it's fuck you regardless of the situation. You know, there's a gun in your face. There's a bazooka aimed at your house. They've got a gun to your wife or whatever. You know, you have to have the fucking intestinal fortitude to fucking say fuck you. And that kind of thing, I think, goes a lot further. If you think about what one of the strengths of the Japanese Army was in World War II, and I know it's not a great thing to point to when we're talking in terms of victories, but there's something to be learned about the way that they fought. You know, it was they were willing to go to their demise to protect what they valued, what they valued.
And when you have a society that whose values are artificial, whose values are meaningless, whose values are, you know, something they don't even think about, well, then it's much easier not to have people like that who are willing to. What are you willing to die for? What are you willing to? I mean, there's soldiers in Afghanistan right now who are asking themselves that same question every day. What the hell are we doing here? And your analogy that you've got a gun to your head. You know, that you're living under a gun, I think that's a mental image that we need to cultivate, is that, you know, you do, if you live in this system, if you follow these rules, the biggest reason you follow these rules is because there is a gun pointed to your head. It's not a figurative gun, it's a literal, you know, at the end of the day, the government will enforce its rules, enforce its laws by pulling out a gun and demanding that you obey. Demanding that you're subservient at gunpoint, that's what they have. Who lives like that? What human being would choose to exist in a situation where there's a gun over their heads 24/7? Yet that's where we find ourselves. Here we are, under the gun, and you know, this is what we call freedom. This is what we think is free.
But there's roughly what? 7 billion people, 6 or 7 billion people on this planet, and they're all they're comfortable looking down the barrel of that gun, doing what they're told. I mean, to me, I picture like one of those old documentaries about the construction of the pyramids in Egypt, and they flash that quick scene of someone snapping a whip to somebody else's back, and that person's dragging this big heavy stone behind them. That's exactly how I see it.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Nothing's changed. It's just the whip now looks like a law, and that rock now looks like it looks like a job. It looks like a stop sign. It looks like a stoplight. It looks like a fucking noisy neighbor whose dog's barking all the time.
Right, it's the burden that you have to carry in order to sustain yourself when you'd rather be doing something else. You'd rather find it. I mean, it'd be one thing if the pyramids were built by people who enjoyed moving heavy fucking rocks. That would be one thing. You know, same thing with our lives. You know, it'd be one thing if whatever people do. You know, if people truly enjoy, I don't know, living in spending 8 hours a day in a cubicle, talking to strangers on the phone about whatever it is they're selling or whatever it is they're pushing. And there are animals like that who enjoy that shit, you know, but it's when the majority of people that are in that environment, they do so because they have to. They do so because it's the best possible option of a very limited set of options they have. And we talk about how, you know, one day we're going to take over some spot in Florida. We're all going to move to, you know, some spot here. And there's going to be enough of this neighborhood that we can kind of put off the laws that are placed on. Even if society keeps going as it is, that we'd be able to go, you know, we can kind of circumvent the laws by going, you know, we do have these little things we have to cater to for these people on the outside to make it look good, but we don't do that shit here. You know, nobody calls the cops in this neighborhood. We deal with it ourselves. I'm thinking about communities in Alaska. Communities in Canada, where they're small communities, 100, 200 people. Everybody fucking knows everybody. Maine, for Christ's sake, everybody knows everybody, and they deal with one another. And it's like, we handle, there's city business and state business or whatever, and then there's like in Maine, island business, basically, where all these people, they live in this little fucking island and spend half the year totally isolated from everything else. And this is just how they live. So you deal with shit yourselves. You have similar values. You have shared bloodlines. So you have a reason to be committed to one another. And if a law doesn't fucking make sense from the state or whoever, if a law doesn't make sense, well, you know what? Here on the island, we just don't deal with that shit.
Right on. I mean, that's, you know, and that's what everybody should be looking for. I mean, really, honestly, if you value the concept of freedom at all, that's the only way you're going to get to it. And, I mean, it's still not completely free, but it's more free.
Right. Right. Well, and that's, I mean, total freedom, absolute, just not a, not a possibility. Not, you know, we exist in a form that requires there are certain limitations. But, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, another method of achieving whatever, you know, this thing we're trying to achieve, you look at these churches, okay? The temple, especially here in the United States, where there's separation of church and state, and even though that concept is bullshit, within the temple walls, the life of this monastic society is very different than the life outside it. And Amish communities like that, where they have their own rules. They do things themselves. It's the same mentality that, you know, this is something that they group or gather in small numbers so that they can maintain and organize themselves based on their own standards.
I mean, again, that's the fucking golden child. That's what we're going after. I mean, that I'm all about the separatist mentality at this point. I mean, it's kind of interesting because the way I see it right now, it's almost more logical to just, you know, cross every boundary just because it's a boundary, you know, jump. It reminds me of that old Tesla song, you know, signs, you know, the whole part about the character being discussed in there is that he, you know, he jumps over the fucking fence with the signs all over it and says, "What gives you the right?"
Right, right.
Yeah, you know, it's crazy because there's just always been this undercurrent of this kind of, I don't know, disdain, and yet so few are willing to actually act upon it. I mean, you know, growing up as a kid, I looked to all these figures from the Revolutionary War. That was my big thing growing up. If you can't tell, just from, you know, the way that I talk and everything, Nathan Hale, my only regret is that I have but one life to give for my country. You know, that kind of defiance has always been it's always been a prized virtue to me.
And I think what we're working for now is, you know, I regret that there's only one life I have to give for my ideology, for my own set of standards, for my own way of living. And that's
what the country was about at that time. I mean, that's the important thing to understand, that they weren't talking about some kind of national identity. They were talking about a very small scale set of virtues, much like we're discussing.
Right. Well, you know, yeah. You do it. We're fighting for the right to do what the hell we want, as long as we don't fuck with somebody else in the process. That was pretty much it. And if you didn't like the way things are going in a particular village or a particular city, well, just move west. You'll eventually get far enough where you don't have to deal with any fucking buddy.
Okay. You know, it's amazing to me because there's like this polar extreme in human mentality, you know, it's something I've noticed, and particularly when it comes to animals. Some people love their pets like that's one of their children or whatever, and if anything were to happen to it, they would be scarred for life, you know. Other people, it's just a fucking animal, and
right.
That does shoot it, put it down, whatever. I mean, I personally kind of, you know, I lean somewhere in between there, and that when I decided that an animal is part of my family, it's part of my family. Mm-hmm. But again, they're just fucking animals, you know. Lion standing there licking its chops at you, growling. Do you go? I'm not going to shoot it between the eyes because that would be cruel. or do you put that fucker down? And
right.
I think the sooner we get to the idea that we as humans are just fucking animals, and some of these lions, some of these animals are looking at us, you know, baring their teeth, growling, it's time to start putting these fuckers down.
Right on.
Figuratively, literally, whatever. To me, you know, which ends you take to liberating yourself are not necessarily important. What is important is striving for that liberation.
Right, and it's another mode of transgression. It's, you know, recognizing, you know, transgressing the system, recognizing that you can't negotiate with someone you oppose unless you first are on equal footing, unless you're on equal terms. The people of these Occupy movements are not on equal terms with the people they're trying to negotiate with. They're not even close. So, you know, the negotiation is going to fail. So you don't negotiate with an opponent until you're able to establish that you have equal footing with them. And that means, you know, conflict. That means taking the things you need to establish that equality, if you're even going to choose to negotiate with them in the future. At some point, you just, if you can turn your back on those that system, that enemy, that thing you oppose, and show that you can exist just fine without it, that's when you'll start to actually, you know, establish some equality.
Right on. You know, it's interesting because I believe that at least America is going through what I like to refer to as the unhappy marriage. You know, you've been through a divorce, so you kind of know what I'm talking about. But
sure.
But the last year or so of marriage, you know, you live with this person, you can't really stand to be around them. Everything that you try to do to make the situation better ends up backbiting you and creating more discomfort and causes the air to get heavier. You know, and it's just owning to that fact that you can, in fact, walk away and be just fine without that person, that your world will not end, that people will, some people will quit talking to you, some people won't, and it doesn't really matter because in the end it's all about finding your own free mind space again. You know, I lost a good portion of myself in my little 5-year marriage. And it took a long time to get that shit back. It one day, I mean, it was crazy. I guess I could kind of tell the story a little bit. I'm not going to describe what was actually wrong in the marriage because it's not really up to the point. But we had gotten to that point that I'm describing, that point of we're together because, well, we got married and, you know, if we get divorced, it's going to be this horrible thing, right? So I get this job offer to go down to Fort Myers. And thing is, there's not enough time for me to go down there and really look for a place for us to move to. And our lease isn't up in the place that we're at anyways. So I and myself and her both make the decision that I will go down there, work through the season, and then when the season is over, we will then move ourselves over there. So that's exactly what happened. She stayed 2 hours north and 6 counties away, and I went down there and I worked for the summer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that period in time, that separation, was enough for me to really start mulling things over and the stuff that I was unhappy about. And I didn't really necessarily realize that that was what was going on in my mind as we, it was happening. It was just kind of a behind-the-scenes constant activity of thought that was going. You know, the nightly phone calls, you know, the phony I love you, good night, you know. So I, season's up, I come up here, I pack her up, our stepdaughter. We fill the U-Haul with our shit, move down there. And we begin unpacking and everything, get everything settled in, and then we're there for about, I don't know, 24 hours. And then I got what I called the 4th of July bug. Well, because my job was so demanding and I was working so many hours, not resting enough, I would break down physically. And so I would be sick for a few days after that. So I was in bed, kid you not, for 3 days, getting pumped full of antibiotics from the doctors, trying to get myself back up to health. And on the third day, when my strength had returned to me, I opened my eyes and I said something to my wife at that time. And she looked and she said something else to me. And whatever she said, it irritated me so fucking much that I said, you know what? You got to fucking go. And that was it. I packed her shit back up into a U-Haul and I sent her on her way. And that's exactly how my divorce went down.
And in our society, I mean, this is the situation we're looking at, is that we are dissatisfied. We are in that point where it's an unhappy marriage with the system, where the expectations that we went into this thing with aren't being fulfilled, that we have traded those expectations, those high ideals, one at a time for something other than what we think we should be getting from this relationship, from this system that we're engaged in. The problem, of course, we have here is that this system is designed, I mean, just like you said, people stay in those types of relationships because of complacency. It's because it's easy. It's easier to just put up with that person's shit one more day than to have the fucking breakup, to get the fuck out. Or, you know, and a lot of people, just like you're saying, they don't think there's another option. You're in it, and that's it. And when we're talking about a society, when we're talking about this kind of situation, again, that's, you don't think you have another option. I mean, these people that complain about the way things are in the United States, you'll hear other people say, well, if you don't like it here, just move. Well, you know, that's a damn good idea. You know, if you don't like it here, well, then just get the hell out. But, you know, or just go someplace and just start doing things the way you think they should be done. But it's a matter of, you know, will we ever reach a point, you know, will enough of us ever reach a point where we just go, you know, fuck it, I'm tired of this shit and I'm out. And do we have to have that? Do we have to have that tipping point where there's enough of us? What does that mean? For me, it's only going to take one other person to make that decision, and she's asleep on the couch right now. You know? So, you know, that's, right. It's if yeah, if she said, we're let's do this, we're done, well then we're done. So it's just a matter of making that, coming to that conclusion that, you know, it's worth the risk. It's worth the breakup. But yeah, I mean, most people, the system's set up to just make it seem like, oh, it's just easier to stay involved. Yeah, it sucks, but it's easier to stay in it. You know, it's better to be a cog than nothing at all. You know, that same thing we were talking about earlier, that, you know, you'll feel like you're alone. You don't want to be alone. Well, the fact of the matter is you won't be. You know, life will not end. The sun will still come up fucking the next day. You know, even though you are, well, fuck it, homeless, jobless, and you have no clue what it is you're going to do. I keep thinking back to this PhD I read about who had spent like the last 40 years roaming the earth, you know, no job, no permanent address, nothing, and totally content with his life.
Yeah, because he's doing what he wants to do, and that's exactly what it's about. I mean, that's precisely the course that I've set myself on. It's almost becoming a null point as to whether a system exists outside of my own domain or not, in that I have my mindset that I am going to do whatever the fuck it is that I want to do, and nothing will stop me. If something does try to stop me, I'm going to look it square in the fucking eyes and say, over my dead body. And if it is my dead body, well, my only regret is that I only can die once for it.
Right on. Right on. And that type of attitude is the attitude that needs to be cultivated. If there's ever going to be, you know, I mean, I think about, you know, the species being stagnant from the way things are going. That, you know, we, you know, in 1969, we sent a rocket to the moon, and we haven't you know, gone back and done shit since. You know, once the Luna program went away, we haven't gone any fucking where. We haven't done anything. That our potential as a species is being denied by this, you know, complacent, you know, adherence to a particular system. And it's a corpse anymore. That there are more dead people out there than people alive. You know, sure they're driving cars and they're going to jobs and everything else, but they're dead. They're dead inside. You know, they've got nothing else, no spark, no urge to learn or grow or improve or any fucking thing. And that's not what I want to be. That's not what I want my kids to be. And it's just a matter of figuring out, okay, obviously we need to transgress. We need to break free. We need to start breaking some fucking rules, starting, I think, with our values. It's a mental exercise to try to figure out, well, where do you go from there? So we're more than halfway through the show. Thought we'd take a little break. I'm going to throw out the number there real quick, 347-989-1371. We're going to run our one commercial, and pretty soon we're going to have some other commercials, I think. But we're going to run the one commercial, and then we're going to come back, and we'll be taking your calls. And we're discussing the Occupy movement, some of the issues that have been going on with it, and transgression, and what it is that we should be doing, or what it is we should consider as options as we try to break away from the system. So I'll hit the button right now.
Creative Oddity Studios. Creative Oddity Studios. Stickers, T-shirts, skateboard decks, lighters, prints, posters, and many other fine pieces of merchandise. It's some of the best damn artwork you'll find on the internet. The creative assault and meandering of Jason Sorrell, T.C. Downey, and Vanessa Lee. Coleman, what is best in life? Crush your enemies. See them driven before you. And visit Creative Oddity Studios. Bondage art. Digital manipulation. Erotica. Demon girls. Fantasy. Tattoo art. Horror. Occult. And we dare to call it artwork.
It's like candy, but for your eyes!
Check out our very popular books on the occult and Satanism. Now available in hard copy and downloadable format. Hoo-wah! Check out our blogs on art, tattoo work, what life is like as a tattoo artist, social issues, philosophy, lowbrow culture in Austin, Texas, and eminentmind.info. You'll enjoy them.
If you can read!
Creative Oddities Studios, www.creativeoddities.com.
I like the naked girls.
Creative Oddities Studios.
Love that commercial.
So, call number 347. Go ahead, dude.
What's that?
I was going to give the call out number again, but what were you going to say?
I was just going to say that really is probably one of the most humorous things that I've seen or heard in a really, really long time. I don't know. There's something about the overall campiness of it that, I think just blows it out of the water and makes it well worth the advertising, so to speak.
Well, I wanted it to be entertaining. I wanted to get the name of the company or the website out there. I want people to come check out the artwork, and I wanted to know that, you know, it's supposed to be fun. You know, it's supposed to be a little bit over the top, a little bit ridiculous, you know, a little edgy. And I wanted the commercial to be kind of just another piece of the whole, you know, the whole pie, basically. Not just a straight up, you know, not too serious, not too, you know, not too ridiculous. But yeah, that's kind of what I was going for, was camp. And yeah, there's a lot of people who said that they really enjoy the commercial. And the other thing I was thinking about is how I plan on having this thing played over and over and over again. Well, I wanted to make it something that, you know, you didn't get tired of listening to after the first three or four listens, that hopefully, you know, you continue to giggle a little bit every once in a while when you hear your favorite part of it. So
kind of swinging back towards what we were discussing before we went to commercial break. I remembered while we were kind of talking about this shift and I don't know, evolution, so to speak, and that our own personal evolution is being stifled through all of these restrictions and stuff that we have going on. A few days ago, this cat, Taruk, Michael, the Dead Idea, he's now Mr. Blonde, he posted up a blog. And the blog was just a link to this Discover Magazine article. The title of the article was, "If Modern Humans Are So Smart, Why Are Our Brains Shrinking?" And I thought that was just really fascinating. It wasn't a super long article or anything. I don't know, maybe half a dozen paragraphs. Actually, it looks like there's a couple pages to it now that I'm looking at it. But either way, I think it's interesting that the way that we're governing ourselves, and this is it's my opinion, I believe it's a direct result, that the fact that we don't have to develop the same kinds of skills and stuff, as we've discussed many times before here on this particular show. There was a time when it was important for you to know how to make a sharp blade, to forge metal out of ore. There was a time when it was important to know how to milk a cow or to sew a shirt. You know, these things have been left behind, and I think it's honestly making us stupider, the fact that everything is just handed to us and we're just able to sit on our seven asses and pick berries off the tree, so to speak. And I mean, it's really neat seeing this article show up and then, at the same time kind of patting myself on the back, because I've been calling it for a couple of years that there's definitely been some kind of a evolutionary activity in humans, but it's not necessarily going in the upward direction, so to speak.
Oh, definitely, definitely. When people stop having to think, well, then when people are no longer challenged, well, then evolution is going to become stifled. It's going to stop, and that's what we're seeing. Nobody wants to be challenged anymore. Nobody wants to take that risk. They may look at these different people in their society, look at these different heroes, and gangster rappers or whatever, and go, oh, well, those guys, the thug life, they're really really living hard. No, they're not. They're just fulfilling another stereotype. They're just doing another fucking thing that is expected of them. None of them really doing anything to try to survive. None of them really doing anything to try to find themselves. So, yeah, it's going to take some of us actually, grasping that again. Being smarter animals, basically.
It's just fucking ridiculous in my mind, the way that this constant nullification of intellect is happening. Some of the shit that my 4-year-old is bringing back to me from, I'm guessing, preschool is just amazing. I mean, he's lucky enough that he's being challenged in his class, but his mom actually had to move him school. The initial preschool that she put him in, the teacher that he was originally working with actually had the kids learning things and teaching them, their letters, their numbers, color shapes, whatever, all the stuff that, the kids should have learned at home anyway. But the teacher that took over that class, when that teacher left, all she wanted to do was let them play. Well, that's not fucking school of any kind. That's daycare. You know what I'm saying? So,
right.
For as dumb as this lady is, my son's mother, for as retarded as she is, she made one good choice, in my opinion.
Moving
him to school that's going to challenge him, because that's what anybody needs to grow. I think to myself, I came from a single mother, widowed mother at that, who had two boys, and she didn't make very much money. We lived, you know, in the projects of a very, very, very small town, so you can only imagine. I mean, that right now the town's population is only 8,000, and this is shit 30-plus years ago. So you can imagine how small that area was, but we came from nothing. And, you know, we were constantly challenged. If we wanted a new TV, well, Mom couldn't just buy us one for Christmas. It meant, you know, washing 1,000 cars that summer. You know, taking $2 every car and washing 1,000 cars. Yeah, that's right. The kind of thing we had to do. We had to find ways to make it work. I can remember being a 10, 11-year-old kid, and I wanted to have a loud stereo in my room. So what I did was, as I saw people throwing stereos out, I salvaged through them to see which ones I could, you know, make work.
Right on, right on. And, well, and that's, I think that's one of the things that, you know, we lack. Your son going to preschool is being challenged by one teacher and another teacher just lets him play. Well, our society is that way, that, you know, we're just allowed to play. And so I think that's another aspect of transgression is finding ways to challenge yourself, making that conscious choice to be challenged, to not be comfortable, but to seek out different, you know, obstacles, to seek out different conflicts and engage those conflicts. And it could be anything. I mean, it could be, you know, anything that you take an interest in, but, you know, is striving for something beyond what it is you can do. You know, as an artist, it's, you know, it falls back to that same thing, is that you never want to be just content with what it is you've accomplished, what it is you do. You always want to try to do better, to do more. Well, go even further. Try doing something radically different. Try doing something, you know, outside of what it is you would normally do, so that you develop certain new skill sets. You develop different things going on. So when you're talking about, like I mentioned, values earlier, the same thing applies. You transgress these value systems by not only questioning the values you have, but trying some things out that you wouldn't normally even consider. Trying to expand those parameters, your set of options, through your own efforts of, you know, that's one of your challenges, is what's going on out in the world that I wouldn't even normally think about.
Right on. I mean, that's something I'm actually myself dealing with pretty heavily at this point, is I guess I missed a big chunk of what was going on in the world. I got so self-involved that and I wasn't watching the news. I wasn't really paying attention to a lot of things. And so as I've, over the past year or so, really changed my perspective and started really looking at the situation as a whole, my eyes have really kind of opened up. And I'm kind of appalled that we have even gotten to the point that we're at. I mean, it really gives me a level of distaste for my fellow man when I think that they've allowed us to, you know, continue on this way.
Right, but again, it's just a matter of what's easy. It's easier to maintain the status quo than to try to do something different. It's easier to just keep doing things the same way we've always been doing them than to try to improve or try to be better. And, you know, trying to define even what that is. What is better? Set those, you know, trying to figure out what standards you're going to set for yourself. It's, you know, and it's something that we all have to, you know, individually choose to engage in. And then, of course, what happens is, you know, you find people who are like-minded, who see the value in making those same kinds of efforts and who strive, you know, on a parallel course to where you're going, so that you can begin to, you know, assist each other. So you can begin to collaborate on different things and really work towards, you know, those end goals, being better, being distinct, being free of the system, breaking away, living your own life, really defining what your life is. So, you know, we're talking about transgression. I think we talked about, you know, questioning your values, really developing your own set of values, what things you actually believe. And I think that when we talk about, you know, of shift in values, one of the things that I would recommend or suggest is the same thing that's suggested by the ONA documentation, trying to be amoral, trying not to have a moral dogma that you live by. There's something to having certain standards, something to having certain rules. But rules don't always apply to every situation. So rules can become an excuse. These morals can become a reason not to do something that's necessary. Just the same, though, as you know, having a certain standard and maintaining that standard even under adversity also can create development. But I think most of us are used to maintaining certain standards or fulfilling certain obligations and not so much, you know, choosing to live without those standards, without those moral values, without that compass. And then through that process, reaching that zero point and then beginning to rebuild and strive to create whatever moral values that we think we should have on our own, picking and choosing and making sure that these things are consciously given to us rather than something that we've just been handed down by somebody else. And again, it means pushing these limits. It means doing things that you're told you shouldn't do.
Right, man. I would say it shouldn't be a matter of whether you're told you should or shouldn't do something. It should be a matter of, is it necessary? You know, is it necessary to achieve whatever it is that needs to be achieved? And I mean, we could kind of wrap right back around to Maslow's hierarchy of need and kind of point to the different levels where, you know, there are certain things that are absolutely fundamental. And those things you would assume are, I don't know, a God-given right, if I can use that kind of as a tongue-in-cheek expression. But it turns out it's just a facade. It's an illusion. You know, shelter.
Right. Right, and the idea that, you know, the system has these methods of control to limit your access to those very things, those things that should be inherent. You should be able to reach out and pluck it from the trees. You should be able to, through your own effort, to create your shelter, to get your food, to, you know, to do whatever. There should be no middleman. You should not have to go through any processor or any authorized, you know, place of sale to get these things. You should just be able to go out and get them for yourself. But that's not what goes down. Here in the city, you know, we don't have the option. There are laws. These are laws. They're everywhere. You can't pitch a tent in the city and just sleep. Why the fuck not? You know, why? What harm is there in pitching a tent someplace and sleeping for the night? If you get up the next day and move on, you know, no harm, no foul. If you stay there and actually do something with the land that you're on, you know, if it's a public piece of property, if it's not being used by anybody else, who gives a shit? Yet, if you're seen doing this, the cops feel like they have, well, the city feels like they have an obligation to go tell you, hey, you're not living by the standards the rest of us are living by. We don't like that, so you have to stop.
And that there's the meat and the potatoes of the problem, man. You know, it's this mentality that you got to look into your neighbor's window, and if you see something that offends you, well, it's your civic duty to fucking stop it.
Right. If you're not conforming,
it's just not the case.
Right. If you're not conforming, if you're not living by the standards that everybody else is living by, then the reaction is, well, then we need to bring this guy back in line, because his choosing or her choosing to do what she wants, to live the life that she chooses to live, well, I think it's a poor reflection on the way that I live my life, because I'm not willing to make those choices. I lack the strength of will to actually go out there and take that risk. So rather than face my own issues and, you know, live my own life based on those same ideals, I'm going to force him to stop living the way they choose to live.
Right on. Interesting. Real quick, I just wanted to kind of tag in there. There's a couple of people. Tim is hardcore. You know, Tim, you know, I dig you, so you just have to take this and grit it. But, you know, what is it? I mean, what he's saying is it depends on what your neighbor is doing. But what I want to know is what is it any of your fucking business what your neighbor's doing? Stratification will happen one way or the other. If they're in there killing little kids or something, it ain't going to be long before there's a mob of angry parents with pitchforks and torches taking care of the problem. You know, so I don't really see why it's any of your fucking business. You know, and most of the time people aren't in there killing little kids. You know,
he points out another example here. If he is killing his wife, well, frankly, if he's killing his wife, and you're at home in your house, honestly, what does it have to do with you? And what? Why don't you? He says, why don't I take care of it? Well, because it's not your wife. It's not. It's quite frankly, it's none of your goddamn business. But and I see his point. This is the morality that's been driven into us. This is the decision making process that we've been trained, you know, to take into account. But frankly, human behavior is that in most situations, you could be out on the street and somebody's beating the shit out of his wife, and most people will not lift a finger to do a goddamn thing about it, and rightly so, that it's up to her to deal with that. Okay, and it might be me next. Well, then you buy a gun, you do what you got to do to defend yourself. So you know that when it becomes you, then do something about it.
I think that's fairly reasonable, yeah. I think beyond that, you know, to be honest with you, when you offer up the hero, when you offer up somebody who's going to come in there and save the day, when you offer up, you know, whatever you want to call them, the knight in shining armor, you allow somebody else to step into the role of the victim rather than being their own hero. You know, and life is full of trials and tribulations. And sometimes you beat those trials and sometimes you fail at them. And, you know, the level at which it happens, I think, can be undiscriminated.
And I want to address, you know, what he's saying here with this, because you're providing an extreme example. And from the logical, rational point of view, the argument that we're making, you don't have any right to interfere with what's going on in somebody else's house. However, what we're talking about is people taking a more direct responsibility in determining the values and morals they'll live under, you know, in their particular area. So like Tim is hardcore, if you say, you know what, I don't want to live around a group of people that would see harming their own spouse as negative and something that should be stopped by not just you know the husband or the wife, but by the neighbors if they see it going on. That community then, but you've engaged in that process. You're talking to a group of people or you're dealing with a group of people who all agree with you on that point. So if there's somebody that disagrees with you, well then yeah, they move along, they move on. Okay, but from the arguments, you know, of being self-determined and doing what you want to do on your own, well, that means then if you're self-determined, you have to allow for the self-determination of others, which means if the shit doesn't affect you, if the shit doesn't come down on into your yard, well, then it's not your goddamn problem. Now, we do too much. We give too much of ourselves over to the state. You know, we give too much authority of our lives over to other people. Which is why we have to take this hard tact, which is why we have to take this hard rationale and in the situation you're describing, say, none of my goddamn business.
And there's two things I actually kind of want to point to here. The first of which is you don't know the situation at hand, or maybe you do know your neighbors really well, but I mean, if the woman herself chose to be in a relationship with a man who had the capability of killing her. You know, I mean, that kind of thing is certainly not something that just springs on somebody. That takes years of psychological fucking, I don't even know what you'd call it, dysturbia. It manifests in many ways. There's warning signs going to it. You know, well, she chose to play with fire, and now she's getting burnt. I mean, there's a consequence to every action. And I don't think it's personally up to us to decide which consequences we allow to, you know, take their course for which actions.
That's the first thing I'd like to
point out. The next thing I think I would actually kind of aim at is, and I'm trying to actually wrap my mind around because it was the second point to this. It's always been a thing, or at least in more modern times, it's been a thing to look at somebody whose behavior is different than yours and point and call them a barbarian or call them an infidel or call them a whatever you want to call them, a Gentile, and then throw stones at them because they behave differently than you. Yet, it might be perfectly normal behavior in their culture. I mean, you could look at it this way. What if that woman had actually contracted HIV and then was carelessly passing it along to, you know, as many men as she could do? What if the husband came home and, you know, he's got the papers in his hand. He knows, hey, I've been faithful, and all of a sudden I have HIV. There's something going on.
Well, I think to your first point, where, you know, if a person chooses to put themselves in a situation where they're at risk, you know, you said, you know, Tim is hardcore. Basically saying that, you know what, if I catch the neighbor killing his wife or beating his wife or whatever, well, then I should intervene. I should step in, because even though she made the conscious choice to be with a man who is violent and he's making the choice to assault her, well, then I should intervene. Well, then, Tim, you should also intervene in every person's decision to be in the military because they're putting themselves in harm's way, that you should take steps to stop those people. That every person that engages in any type of risky behavior, skydiving, whatever, you should put an end to that as well. That you should step in, you should run yourself ragged putting an end to that. Anybody that gets into a car that has horsepower that can make it a serious risk when on the roadways, you should engage in getting involved in that as well. Where does the good guy badge end if you have that mentality?
I would agree with that entirely. I think to seek something outside of that extreme is in itself hypocritical, rather. You know, that's like fucking coming into my house right now and ripping this cigarette out of my hand and stomping on it and saying you should not smoke.
There you go.
You know, it's
killing yourself.
Not your fucking business.
And Morgan Hill says that, you know, fuck it, basically. Call the police and let them deal with it. You know what? If I were to call the police, if the neighbor was killing his wife, the reason I would call the cops is something that she pointed to earlier. The noise was bothering me. So that's where I would intervene. That would be what my motivation would be for intervening, is that the noise was troublesome to me. Other than that, you know, if he could get away with it silently, as a matter of fact, it happens. I'm sure it happens almost every day in this country where, you know, I live in an apartment complex. The dude downstairs could kill his wife, and as long as he was quiet about it, you know, if I heard a thump from her body hitting the ground, I'm not going to give a shit. I'm going to roll over and go back to sleep. And the next day when the cops show up and go, hey, there was a murder downstairs last night. Did you hear anything? Go, fuck no, there was a murder downstairs. Well, yeah, I gotta go. I got shit to do. Yeah, you know, could you make sure the body's out of here before it starts to smell?
You know what kills me, man? We are the only animal on on this fucking planet that gets ourselves into a fucking tizzy fit when other animals, when another animal of the same species kills an animal of that species. I mean, if it was a pack of wolves and one wolf took down the other, they'd just go on with their business. They don't give a fuck. We somehow think that, you know, we're above that. But, you know, my experience is that I breathe the same oxygen. I shit and piss just like they do. I have to eat food just like they do. I can smell, hear. You know, what makes me special?
And yeah, I agree with that. I agree. It's, you know, if it's animalistic behavior. It's, you know, this comes natural to pretty much every fucking thing else. Except for us. And it comes from this idea, this mentality that as human beings, that we rate automatically. We rate greater consideration. It's not something that has to be earned. I'm a person that says you have to earn it. Now, just for the record, if I were living in a community where we were actually defining how we behaved, I would prefer to live in a community that said, hey, you don't kill each other. Okay, that's one of the lines I would draw. That's why I think that's a good idea, that you find other ways to deal with it. And if you got somebody that's truly violent that, you know, can come to a point where they're going to kill somebody, well, then they need to leave the community. So, you know, that makes sense to me. But the rationale there is, though, it's because that's what I choose. It's what I choose for myself, and it's what I would expect others to respect, basically. But yeah, I'm sure there's going to be communities out there where, no, man, if you got a problem with somebody else, you know, there have been communities like this in our country. You got a problem with somebody else, you got a legitimate beef with somebody else, you pull out your gun and you have at it. Now, Tim is hardcore points out animals do defend each other. You're absolutely right. When they have cause to do so, when the animals have a direct reason to defend one another, but they don't go looking for other defenseless animals to deal with. They don't go looking for other animals to regulate their behavior.
Right. Like, I mean, it would be that the two examples being pointed out in the chat room would both be valid if it was, you know, someone of their own lineage or whatever. But, I mean, you're not going to find a mother bear from, you know, the north side of the woods coming over there to protect the cub from the mother bear of the south side of the woods. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah, more often than not, the mother bear coming from the north side of the woods to see the cub from the southern side of the woods being killed will probably actually help with the killing process, because it eliminates competition for their own their offspring.
Right. I mean, I want to point to the Lucifer Principle at this point, the book by Howard Bloom. I think that he definitely deals much better with this particular rationale than you or I are doing right now here on the air. So if you guys haven't read the Lucifer Principle yet, I would recommend picking up a copy of it and taking a look, because when you really put it in perspective, it just makes much more sense this way.
So, and when we're talking about, again, we're talking about transgressing, I think this idea, the automatic sense that we need to, that there's sanctity of life, okay? Sanctity of life is an illusion. Otherwise, the universe would be guided in such a way where things didn't get killed, where, your source of energy doesn't come from the matter material of another organism. Okay, so sanctity of life is a bullshit concept. It's an illusion that we engage in, and it's one of those values that we have to transgress. Once you can transgress that value, once you acknowledge that there's no sanctity of life, you can begin to define then what is worthy of preservation, what is worthy of, for you to step in and try to hold dear and protect.
Agreed. You know, I always hate when all I have left to say at the end of it all is I agree. It kind of one of those things that frustrates me, and it's probably one of the reasons why I participate very little in forums in certain places. Because if all I have to offer is I agree, then it wasn't worth the few seconds that I spent typing up, I agree. So, but all in all, man, I mean, it really is a matter of the fact that we got our priorities all fucked up, and they have been for at least 2,000 years now.
Right, and it really comes down to, you know what, the things that you value now, the things that you cherish, there may be a legitimate reason to cherish those things, like life, like property, like whatever. The problem is that most of us have not come to those conclusions on our own. We haven't tested those theories out and made a rational, conscious decision that these are the things we should do. The majority of us have not. Where, you know, it's just programmed into us. So the point being that we need to actually start about, you know, reviewing and trying to understand our values, trying to understand what is true, what's worthwhile, and what's not.
Absolutely. So we got about 17 minutes left in this show. I think I'm going to throw out the call-in number again, 347-989-1371. If you got 2 cents you want to toss in and you're not in the chat room or you're just hanging out listening, now's the time to call. I'm sure we've offended a few listeners along the way, and my attitude on that is, you know, all of his good day's work. But it's just crazy, because if you if you really think that life is sensuous, it should only be your own or other lives that you found and deemed worthy of valuing. It shouldn't be an inherent automatic. It shouldn't be something you're just entitled to.
Well, and there have been cultures where that mentality was prevalent, where, you know, your life had to be earned. And I think there's something of value there, in my opinion, that if you were, and if you died in defense of your life, well, then that was a good death. That was, you know, that was better than just dying in your bed from illness or disease or from old age. That you actually, you know, sought out that kind of death, and that the manner of your death was just as important as the manner of your life. And people there are people who point out, just like you were saying earlier, that that's kind of a barbaric attitude. And in my opinion, no, there's something elegant and true to that, you know, that just like, you know, living a meaningful life, you know, also should mean having a meaningful death, having a meaningful demise. But
right.
Life, you know, your life is sanctified as long as you have the ability to defend it.
I agree with that. I'm just sitting here thinking to myself that if we all used that kind of measure and actually decided for ourselves what life is valuable to us, how much more we would cherish the lives that we figure or we conceive as being valuable to us. And right now, everybody's kind of at this blasé spot where All life is precious, and so it cheapens it. It's like one of the things an ex-girlfriend of mine said to me way back in high school was that her boyfriend prior said, "I love you so much," that it just meant nothing to her anymore. That it was just, it was a platitude served up with silver spoon, knife and fork, and a nice little a nice little, what the hell do you call those damn trays? And, you know, the moving trays
platter.
In the hotels.
A platter.
No, not the platter itself, but the
serving tray?
Fuck. the serving tray, but yeah, anyway, whatever. It's not important what it is. The point is that, you know, you take away the value of something when you refuse to actually hold it as valuable.
And Tim's Hardcore has pointed out in the chat room, actually most people do not give a damn about anything. That's the problem. Well, when you think the sanctity of life, when you think your own life has meaning and it's just automatic that your life has meaning, that you think that your opinion and your attitudes and your needs have value, are worthy of, you know, pursuit without any effort of your own, that you just have a right to this and the right to that, well, then of course you're not going to care about anything. If you don't give a shit about what you've got going on your own, well, then you're not going to give a shit about what anybody else has got going on. You're not going to care about anything. And so, you know, we talk about, you know, living a good death. Well, like I said, it also means living a good life. And that's a life that's, you know, lived consciously, lived with some effort, with some evaluation, with some actual concern about the manner in which it's lived. We're in the society right now that says, you know what, don't worry about the manner in which you live your life. We're going to tell you how you live your life. When you turn 18, you can join the workforce and continue education until you're 24, 26, 28 years old, and then you join the workforce. And then you're going to work at whatever little job we've got for you, because we've got a limited selection of things you can do for a living until you're, you know, you're 30, 40, 50, 60 years old. At some point, we're going to let you retire. And then when you retire, we're going to take care of you. We'll take care of you completely. So you don't have to worry about any of that shit. So why strive to live a good life? Why strive to have a good death? You're just a cog, just part of the overall process.
Yeah, right. If this was a forum, I'd be typing this in capital letters with an exclamation point at the end.
I noticed somebody in the chat room pointed out that the idea of living a good death, you know, Norse mythology, it also comes from the Japanese, the Book of the Samurai, the Hakakuri. So it's multiple cultures where there was real consideration as to what a life was. And not everyone was entitled to a life. When we talk about Gurdjieff's talking about how not everyone is born with a soul, no one is born with a soul, that a soul is something that has to be developed. I think he's talking about the exact same thing here, that you're not automatically, there's not automatically a purpose to your existence. There's 7 billion people running around. You might be surplus people. And it's up to you to decide whether or not you are surplus, you are fodder for the machine, or whether you actually have some meaning and that you're going to have an impact and then you're going to make something happen. And as we've been pointing out, we think that requires transgressing these values, these morals, these laws, these rules that we have that limit us to that machine aspect, to that, you know, being fodder.
I can't stress that importance enough. You know, I know you're a busy boy usually during the day on Saturdays, so you haven't been really catching the Saturday show as much. But we've been talking a lot about the Eastern ideas of left-hand path and what that really means. And what it boils down to is knowledge developed through actual practice. And I can't say enough that that's exactly what I believe in. It's not enough to sit around in my mind and rationalize something without actually trying it out and deciding for myself.
Absolutely. Tim's Hardcore, I transgress the idea that I should not care. See, that's if you're... Not caring is not part of the process. It's not you actually have to engage. You actually have to care. But it's a matter of deciding for yourself what it is you will or will not care about. So, you know what? In the situation you were describing earlier, if you want to charge into that neighbor's house and put an end to the violence that's going on there, well, put on your red cape and have at it, man. But there are a lot of us who are going to sit there. As a matter of fact, the state that you live in is going to sit there and say, you may not have had any business charging in, especially if you can't establish with, you know, through your good deed that you actually, you know, you were stopping a murder. If you were just stopping a beatdown, well, then you had no right to break in their door, typically. So, you know, but again, so it's a matter of evaluating. It's not the automatic, we have to stop that. It's not an obligatory kind of thing. It's your choice.
You know, I love horror movies, and one of the common plots in a horror movie that I see is, you know, there's two people in the house or whatever, and there's one guy killing them, and the one guy's busy, you know, he's trying to take out one particular person, and this other guy decides to try to step in the way, and all he does is get his shit stabbed. That's it. It's all he does. He ends up being the dude that dies, while this other person runs off to, well, fall prey later normally, but that's it. You're just murdering yourself.
Right. Right. Well, yeah, it's, and, you know, the senseless death, basically. Yeah. We got about 8 minutes left. So if anyone wants to call in, 347-989-1371 to share any last thoughts you have on this. And I was really trying to get, you know, I really wanted to focus on transgression and what you do. Not so much, I think we've really beaten up on the whole why and the importance of and everything else. And wanted to start talking about, you know, the what. So I think maybe next week that's something we should really focus on is, you know, by different groups, what it is we're engaging in, that kind of thing.
Right on. Well, like I said, I've got in my mind, this is a Republican National Convention that's coming here. I've got in my mind that I really want to use that to my benefit. So maybe that's something that'll be worthwhile to discuss next week.
Right on. Well, and I was going to ask, you know, if you could really quick, so that, you know, just in preparation for next week, why do you want to fuck with the Republican convention in Tampa?
Well, like I said, the area here, as far as I understand the demographic, is predominantly Democratic. Now, I don't agree with either particular philosophy. I think both need to burn down. Well, you know, the art of war suggests that, having someone else fight your battle makes it easier to win in the end. You know, if you send, if you're England and you send the French in to invade Italy, well, you've just taken care of armies of both sides that you're against.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's kind of my thinking here.
So in order to engage that successfully, you get the progressive groups in your area whipped up and fired up about going and making sure that they cause as much trouble for this conservative event. And then in the meantime, you have to be prepared to capitalize on those gains. You have to be prepared to show where both parties are just fucked up and demonstrating it through their conflict.
Exactly.
Right on.
Exactly.
Right on.
So that this is what I'm trying to figure out here, because it would be easy enough to get people fired up. And the question is how to monopolize on that fire once you get it going.
Right on. So,
so
we got about 5 minutes left, man.
Right on. It's all good, dude. What are you? I saw that incredible tattoo you did.
Yeah. Silver Dot. I never know if I should call him Ken or what. Ken's local. He's a pretty cool dude, and we've been talking about this tattoo since April, since the Walpurgisnacht party, and finally got a design that he really dug and everything else. Broke away from the suggestions he kind of made because he wanted something like this, but didn't necessarily want that. So. Threw down that design, got that taken care of this Saturday. I'm happy with it. He's happy with it. The funny thing is, here we are talking while, of course, he's getting the tattoo done. He works in a place where he doesn't, you know, he doesn't necessarily advertise the fact that he's in Satanism. He considers himself a Satanist. But he did advertise the fact that he was getting this back piece done, you know, Saturday to the people he worked with. So, of course, tomorrow he's going to go to work and, you know, they're going to want to see his new tattoo. And I'm curious as to how he's going to handle that. But he said that he's actually been walking around without a shirt on last couple of days and drumming up a lot of business for me. So that's
kind right
of
on.
Yeah.
I mean, shit, man. It took you 4.5 hours, and that's like tattooing the side of an ox. And he's not a small dude.
Right. Yeah, he's not a little dude.
Yeah, so,
but it was
I
fun.
Mean,
it was fun.
But that tattoo's got to be what? Like at least 14, 15 inches wide by 6 or 7 inches tall.
Yeah, it was 14 inches wide, and I don't know how tall it was. But yeah, he took it like a champ. I told him I was going to give him a lot of shit and everything else. And so if he catches the archive, everybody can tell him, you know, that I said that, you know, he took the tattoo like a champ. He endured it, you know, on his spine and everything, man. It was, you know, it was rough, and he took it. I told him I was going to tell the world, being in the Army, I was going to be able to tell the world that I made a Marine cry, but he didn't shed a tear or anything, but I thought it would be funny to fuck with him a little bit. But
right on. So everybody should go back and say, oh, so Jason made a Marine cry, huh?
Yeah, just make sure to point out that, no, that I said that I was going to say that, but I have a lot of respect for Ken, you know. And
right on.
It was a cool tattoo. Have the opportunity to do it. It's a big deal. It's going to be a nice piece in my portfolio. So, yeah, that rocks.
Right.
I guess I wanted to talk about real quick. The next Ooze episode will be the Luminous episode on the 15th. And we're going to be discussing, let's see. Just we're going to talk about the future, it looks like. This is an idea that Rotten Biohazard had that we're just going to go ahead and talk about. You know, here we are talking about all these different issues, and we're just kind of project based on the trends and everything else what we see as some different possibilities, both good and bad. So it's an hour-long show. Call in if you got some opinions about, you know, the future. And if you go to the Ooze WordPress page, oozeradio.wordpress.com, I've actually put in a month's worth of little synopsises for the Luminous edition. So check that out and comment on stuff. If you get in there, you can leave a reply. So if you got some thoughts on the different topics or whatever on any of the Ooze shows, make sure to leave a comment because that could actually be part of the radio show.
Right on. So with all that being said and done, man, it's time to push the button and get the fuck out of here.
All right, man. Cool. Later.
Later.